Chapter 96, The Attack Repulsed. It is a quiet Sunday morning in Schoonhoven. This is a village situated on the River Lek in the province of South Holland. Listen, from the church sounds solemn psalm singing. Naturally, the inhabitants of Schoonhoven have gone to church. This we also do, do we not? A counter-remonstrant occupies the pulpit. When their beloved preacher commences with his sermon, then the multitude listens attentively to him. Suddenly, a noise is heard outside. Heavy steps in the streets draw the attention of the listening churchgoers. The noise comes closer. Yet a moment, and then the outside door is rudely flung open, and some policemen, led by the bailiff, storm into the church. The bailiff was the head of the police. We no longer use the word bailiff. Today we speak of the chief of police. Well then, with a loud noise, they push into the church. The quiet within has been rudely disturbed. The preacher breaks off his sermon and silently awaits developments. He is roughly dragged from the pulpit and is marched off as a criminal. They take him directly to the heavy city gate. The gate grates open and the faithful preacher is pushed outside. The gate door is roughly slammed shut behind the back of the preacher. And while grinning, the bailiff and his assistants return homeward. In the meantime, the congregation has left the church and has gone away with sorrowful faces. The question arises in their hearts, must it now go this way? Are we then not even permitted to hear God's word preached? Have then the times of the persecution returned? Alas, yes, only no stakes smoked as yet. So much had already happened in Schoonhoven. First, a preacher and an elder were put outside of the city, hence banished, because they did not agree with the remonstrant principles. When after that, five elders and a deacon chose the side of their banished preacher, they were also degraded. That means they were no longer considered as citizens of that town. They were no longer permitted to trade or practice their occupation within the gates of Schoonhoven. They were expelled from society by their fellow citizens. How much misery and sorrow was poured out upon those families. The banished consistory members tried to practice their calling outside of the city. They were even forbidden to do that. They had to pay a heavy fine. Yet the congregation did not give up the conflict. They continued to go to church in the town, but that turned out badly. We just told you that during the service the preacher was removed from the pulpit and taken outside of the city. Well then, if they are not permitted to meet within the gates, then they shall meet outside of the city. One of the church members makes his barn, which stood outside the city, in the field available. Then they shall hold their church meeting in that. But betrayers, who are eager for a quarrel, tell the chief of police about that. He and his helpers immediately run outside. They disperse the congregation and command to pull that barn down to the ground. Soon there is nothing left of that barn but a pile of firewood. It looked as if the times of the Inquisition had returned. Yes, but is all that allowed to go on like that? Is there then no justice left in the Netherlands? That is how the banished elders and deacons thought about that too. They traveled to The Hague and complained before the States of Holland. However, There they were snapped at by Olden Barnevelt and chased away. Pitiful, isn't that so? From this event, it is clearly evident that the struggle still raged in all its violence. This happened in the year 1615, thus 6 years after the death of Arminius. Yes, indeed, and the struggle continued undiminished. Olden Barnevelt did not think about abandoning the fight. He must and would be the victor. In the year 1614, the States of Holland enacted the Tolerance Act. What a scholarly word, isn't that so? We shall tell you in simple words. In that act was written that both parties shall practice forbearance, and the state would define what might be said and taught by the preachers. All this meant that the remonstrants were considered right and could preach freely, but the counter-remonstrants had to keep still. They were no longer permitted to warn the people against the remonstrant doctrine of lies. If they still did that, then they were turned out of their office, at times were maltreated and banished. Then in the eyes of the states, they were intolerable. Some cities in Holland refused to subscribe to that Tolerance Act, but the majority agreed with it. The God-fearing preacher Gazelius lived in Rotterdam. The largest part of the city of Rotterdam was Remonstrants, especially the city pensionary Hugo Grotius, who was a zealous Remonstrant, who in all sorts of ways helped and favored the Remonstrants. There was still only one Reformed preacher in the entire city. The name of that Reformed preacher was Gazelius. But he was a thorn in the eye of the Remonstrants. This preacher had to go too. Gazelius, who knew very well that they wanted to get rid of him, was extremely cautious. He wanted to continue to serve his congregation, and for that reason, he had conceded to the extreme. Every time, wherever he preached, bitter enemies of him sat in his audience. He knew that they sat there for the purpose to catch him in his words. They hoped that he would say something wrong, something grievous against the remonstrant preachers. Then they could accuse him before the city administrators. As we have already told you, for that reason Gazelius was very cautious in his expressions. Their wicked plan did not succeed until... At one time Gazelius had chosen as his text Hebrews 12 verse 4, "Ye have not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin." His enemies smiled happily. Ha! Now they had found something. Gazelius had urged the people to rebel because he had said that they should resist. He had not preached toleration, but resistance. Naturally, this accusation was false. Gazelius had not said that they must fight against the remonstrants, but against sin. Yet, upon the basis of that false accusation, Gazelius was banished by the city government. First, he was put out of his office, by which he was denied the access to the pulpit. Yet the faithful preacher did not want to abandon his congregation. For that reason, he had meetings in homes. The remonstrants did not tolerate that either, and he was banished. Besides, there appeared a placard, a law, that the Reformed were no longer permitted to meet together, not even outside of the cities. If they still did that, then they had to pay a fine of 300 florins, a large sum of money in those days, and the place where they met would be confiscated. Now those miserable counter-remonstrants knew exactly where they stood. Thus it happened in Rotterdam, where Hugo Grotius with his friends played the boss. This history speaks for itself, does it not? A Remonstrant minister lived in Alkmaar by the name of Venator. That man was a zealous Remonstrant. Besides, by his wrong acts, he gave offense to the people. He had, for instance, a number of boys boarding with him, and he permitted them in their leisure time to perform stage plays. Because of these things, he was accused before the consistory, who spoke about that at a classical meeting. This Venator, together with four other Remonstrant ministers, was dismissed by the classes Alkmaar. They were no longer allowed to preach. That decision was just, because they did not speak according to the doctrinal standards. How incensed the States of Holland were when that became known. They demanded from the city council of Alkmaar, that means from the city government, that they should see to it that Venator would come upon the pulpit again. The city council is the same as our city government. Well then, the city council refused to obey that command, and the consistory of Alkmaar refused likewise. But the States of Holland would not put up with that. They would have their own way at all costs. They deposed the city council of Alkmaar and sent them home. The stadtholder, Morris, who had the power to appoint city councils, had to appoint a new government in Alkmaar. This he did, but he appointed all reformed men, that is to say, counter-remonstrants. This new council did not want to compel the classes, and consequently the situation was not changed. Venator was not allowed to preach. And do you know what happened then? The States of Holland drove the newly appointed city council away, and then they themselves appointed a third city council. It is self-evident this consisted exclusively of remonstrants. They were not allowed to do that, because that was the work of Prince Morris. They had no right to do that. But justice no longer existed in Holland in those days. Injustice reigned supreme. Naturally, that third city council, that remonstrant council, saw to it that the wicked Venator came back upon the pulpit again. How horrible, isn't that so? It became so bad that the Reformed were no longer permitted to come together to read the Bible. Indeed, the days of the Spanish Inquisition had really returned. Thus we could tell you much more. In Brielle, the counter-remonstrants were also no longer permitted to come together to read the Bible. If John Copplestock and the sea beggars from the time of 1572 had lived to see that, then they would have asked, have we fought such a terrible war for that? Have we risked our life for that? Who could have ever imagined that in this way the time of the persecution would return once more? Naturally, we cannot discuss everything that has happened. Yet we may not omit one city. That city is The Hague. The leaders of the Remonstrants lived in The Hague. The powerful Grand Pensionary of Holland, Oldenbarnevelt, resided there. All those who were prominent, all those who filled an important place in the city, had chosen the side of the Remonstrants. We can really say that The Hague was the headquarters of the Remonstrants. It is to be understood that also in that city the struggle between the remonstrants and the counter-remonstrants burst loose in all its intensity. The young counter-remonstrant preacher, Roseus, lived also in The Hague. The Lord had given him a bright mind. Besides, he was an excellent orator. He was an ardent follower of Gomeris. But the remonstrant Uten Bogaert also lived in that same city, who, after the death of Arminius, had really become the leader of the remonstrants. He was a very capable man, and his influence was great. He was one of the drafters of the remonstrants, which had been sent to the States of Holland, about which we told you in the previous chapter. The congregation of Roseus consisted almost entirely of plain people, because a great part of the common people had chosen the side of the counter-remonstrants. But all those that were prominent and distinguished went to church by Uten Bogaert. It is self-evident that it came to a clash between those two preachers. Oldenbarnevelt interfered in that quarrel. He demanded that Roseus should live in unity with Uten Bogaert. Yea, they had to hold communion at the same table. And look, Roseus could not do that. Therefore, he steadfastly refused. Oldenbarnevelt resented that so much that the God-fearing Roseus was dismissed as preacher. Whosoever would not bend had to be made harmless. That was the custom among the remonstrants. When at one time after that Oldenbarnevelt met Roseus, the grand pensionary said mockingly to him, "Look, now you stand all alone." And, do you know what Roseus answered? "Oh, no, sir, you are mistaken. I do not stand alone. God, the Lord, is with me. Also, in this country, there are still thousands of pious ones who stand at my side." We do not know what Oldenbarnevelt's answer was to that. Roseus was no longer permitted to preach in The Hague, but do you know what he did? He went to Rijswijk, a small town in the neighborhood of The Hague, and there he preached Sunday after Sunday. Then it became apparent that he still had many friends in The Hague. More than 700 people from The Hague walked every week to Rijswijk to there listen to their deposed minister. They would rather walk for hours to Rijswijk than to sit under the preaching of the remonstrant Uten Bogaert. When those people returned to The Hague in the evening completely fatigued, then they were mocked and laughed at. Then they were railed at as Rijswijk runners and as mud beggars, because when it rained, then they came home wet and with mud-stained clothes. Yea, they were even pelted with stones. All this was not to the liking of Oldenbarnevelt. A stop had to be put to all that running to Rijswijk. Those headstrong ones need not go to Rijswijk. They could also go to church in The Hague. To put an end to that, he proposed to the States of Holland that they should order Morris to forcefully put an end to that. Prince Morris, who also lived in The Hague, had up till now not meddled much with those ecclesiastical quarrels. But that would now change. He had been visited by some counter-remonstrant preachers. With those preachers was also the well-known preacher Trigland. They asked the prince respectfully if he could not arrange it that the counter-remonstrants could go to church in The Hague itself, because in the winter walking to Rijswijk was too difficult, especially for the women and children. During that visit, they said, "Your Highness, they need not even give us a church. Even if it was only a barn or a house, then we would be satisfied." At these last words, Morris shook his head and answered vehemently, "What? We should go in houses or barns? There is no thought of that. We have a right to the churches, and we shall have them too." Greatly relieved, the visitors departed. The so-called mud beggars obtained courage. They refused to go any longer to Ryswyk. A barn is made ready in The Hague to serve as a church. When the administration of The Hague heard that, they caused that building to be locked. What now? That has been a sad disappointment. Secretly, they hope for the support of Prince Morris. And when Morris heard that the administration of The Hague had that barn locked, he was very indignant. "What?" he cried out. "If those people do not receive a meeting place, then I shall put my own house at their disposal." He urgently advises the municipal government to give the large church to the counter-remonstrants. The opponents will not even consider that. The large church? Not likely. Those rebels receive nothing. They shall submit themselves. Alden Barneveld is angry when he hears that Prince Morris has chosen the side of those despised Ryswyk runners. It is not his intention to give in. Prince Morris shall also submit to him. But Morris will not submit. The stadtholder had a bookkeeper in his service. The name of that bookkeeper is Mush. Morris agrees to it, that the oppressed congregation of Roseus meets in his house. Hence a church service is held there for the counter-remonstrants. Alden Barneveld is furious. He shall have that impudent Mr. Mush killed, because he had the audacity to openly defy the commands of the municipal government. However, when he proposes that plan to the government of The Hague, then they dare not do that. Kill Mush? Resist the stadtholder openly, who has silently approved of that? No, they dare not do that. Besides, Prince Morris was backed by his cousin William Lewis, the stadtholder of Groningen and Friesland. He had told Morris for a long time already that he should concern himself with those ecclesiastical quarrels. The remonstrants had nowhere near so much power in Friesland and Groningen, where William Lewis ruled. There they did not get the opportunity to torment the counter-remonstrants. Finally, at the insistence of Prince Morris, the counter-remonstrants received a little church in The Hague, the so-called Hospital Church. But that was far too small and unsuitable for the purpose. The government really does not know what to do about it. A meeting is called where Morris is also present. They ask the stadtholder what he intends to do. In 1586, Morris had become stadtholder. On that occasion, he had taken an oath that he would uphold and protect the Reformed religion. Well then, Morris has those minutes read to him again. Then he says that he shall keep that oath, and that he shall protect and defend the pure doctrine as long as he lives. The Lord Regents and Alden Barneveld try to make Morris believe that the remonstrant doctrine is just as sound as the counter-remonstrants. However, Morris does not agree with that. He contends with Alden Barneveld, and finally He no longer is able to defend himself. Once again, Morris advises them to call a national synod together, and then the preachers from the entire nation can converse with each other about this matter and come to a decision. But the states continue to refuse stubbornly. Thus, the struggle continued. How long yet? It is Sunday, July 6th, 1617. A large multitude is gathered together in front of the large monastery church. As the name already tells us, this church belonged formerly to a monastery. But now it is no longer a church at all. The building is being used as a gun factory. Today we would say it had become an arms factory. That large space was especially suitable for that. Ah, there were sufficient churches in The Hague. Well then, before that building on that Sunday, it is black with people. Say, why? It is Sunday, is it not? No work is done on that day. Neither do all those people stand there to go to work, but because of a different reason. The administration of The Hague had promised that they would have that gun factory put in order again as a church, and then the Reformed, the Counter-Remonstrants, would be permitted to use that church. How happy those oppressed people were! Soon they would no longer need to go to church at Rijswijk, but they would be able to listen to their beloved preacher in the city itself. But their patience was tried. It is true, the administration had promised it, but it lasted so long. Weeks, months passed by, and everything remained as it was. Nothing happened. Finally, the people became impatient. It had lasted so long already. They had waited so long already. And now, on that Sunday, they forcibly take possession of that building. For that reason, such a large multitude has gathered before that gun factory. They force the doors open and crowd inside. But yea, all kinds of materials are still lying in that building. That is nothing. They are not deterred by that. The first service is held there that Sunday morning. The churchgoers sit upon workbenches and upon other objects because there are no pews. Hundreds who cannot obtain a seat remain standing. The service passes quietly and orderly. But the next day, early Monday morning, they return. Everything that stands or lies in that building is dragged outside. Everyone who has but a little time helps along. The entire week, from early morning till late evening, they work hard. The entire building is first emptied, thoroughly cleansed, yea, even repainted. After that, a pulpit is built. Pews are placed, and when it is Saturday evening, then that great project is finished. Hundreds of people have assisted with that. The following Sunday, the doors are opened, and the old gun factory has been transformed within a week, as if by magic, into a trim church. By harmonious cooperation, the impossible may be accomplished. It is a lesson for today. The administration of The Hague did not dare do anything against that. It is several weeks later. It is Sunday again. Behold, Prince Morris and his retinue leave the palace. He is going to church. Nothing unusual, isn't that so? However, they do not go to the large church where Uten Bogart shall preach. No, they walk past those open doors. They walk past the home of Olden Barnevelt. Finally, they come to the monastery church, and they enter there. Morris shows publicly that he has chosen the side of the despised mud beggars. We can understand that these people are glad, since now they obtained a powerful ally. Since that moment, that church has received the name of the Prince's Church. You may be sure that on that Sunday, joy has prevailed in the homes of those plain people. Would their path of suffering be soon ended now? Olden Barnevelt, who of course had heard what had happened, has no intention to give in. He holds out to the very utmost. He tries to have his own way at the cost of everything. In the month of August, in the year 1617, at the insistence of Olden Barnevelt, the Sharp resolution was accepted by the states of Holland and that of Utrecht. We shall try to tell you very simply what was contained in that law. In the first place, the Sharp resolution stipulated that there would be no national synod. The Remonstrants were obviously much afraid of that. In the second place, the Sharp resolution stipulated that the cities were empowered to enlist soldiers. In history, those soldiers are called local militia. Prince Maurice was the commander-in-chief of the army and navy. All officers and soldiers must observe and obey the commands of Prince Maurice. But the local militia need not obey the prince. They must observe the commands of those who had enlisted them and by whom they were paid. Hence, this was the city administration. In that way, two armies came into existence in the Netherlands. The one army must obey Maurice. The other army had to obey the administrators of the cities by whom they were enlisted. That was very dangerous, because by this there was great danger that the nation would become involved in a civil war. But perhaps you shall ask, but what was the duty of those local militiamen? Ah, that is very simple. We have already told you that Olden Barnevelt desired that Morris would use the army to compel the counter-remonstrants to give up their resistance against the remonstrants. We shall give you one example. Every Sunday, about 700 counter-remonstrants went from The Hague to Rijswijk, isn't that so? Well, then, Olden Barnevelt had demanded that the troops of Maurice would forcibly put an end to that. But Prince Maurice refused. He did not want to use his army for that, and without his cooperation, Olden Barnevelt could not have the disposal of those troops. They need not carry out the commands of the Grand Pensionary. Well then, through this Sharp resolution, the cities obtained for themselves the right to recruit troops over which Maurice had nothing to say. Those local militiamen would be used to compel the counter-remonstrants to stay home. Maurice would be unable to do anything against that. And in the third place, the Sharp resolution stipulated that the usual courts of justice were no longer permitted to pass sentence when complaints came in with respect to ecclesiastical matters. From now on, the states of Holland themselves would pass sentence upon ecclesiastical matters. Naturally, we all realize what the object was of that. There were many counter-remonstrants among the judges. They were no longer permitted to pass sentence in ecclesiastical matters, because they would agree with the counter-remonstrants, and that especially was not allowed. That had to be prevented. There was much more in the sharp resolution, but we shall not mention all that. Just remember these three things, because they are the most important. Olden Barneveld was the main instigator of all this. Through this sharp resolution, the country was brought into great danger. That was high treason. The province of Holland had to play the boss over all the other provinces. Now the quarrels were no longer only ecclesiastical, but political. The state church, of which John of Oldenbarneveldt was a great advocate, had to be maintained. Through that sharp resolution, the influence of the state over the church was strengthened. From all this, it is apparent that through the issuing of that sharp resolution, the situation became very dangerous. This could not, this was not permitted to go on like this any longer. Through this, the entire nation was brought into danger. Here, intervention was necessary. Happily, the States General realized that too. We know already that the States General consisted of representatives from all provinces. The States General was primarily counter-remonstrants. Well then, this States General interfered in a strong manner. Two important decisions were made by them. In the first place, they decreed that a national synod would be held. It was no longer asked whether the remonstrants were satisfied with that, but they ordered the calling of a national synod. In the second place, the States General instructed Morris to discharge the local militia, and if it should seem necessary, to change the administration in various cities. Prince Morris has carried out his commission immediately, and he has done it very well. Without the shedding of blood, the local militia everywhere was sent home. God has spared the Netherlands from a bloody civil war. Much could be told about this, but since this chapter would then become much too long, we shall only briefly mention certain things. Morris, with a few representatives from the States General, appeared unexpectedly in Utrecht. Many remonstrants were in this city. Just at that time, the City Council of Utrecht was in session in the City Hall. The zealous remonstrant, Hugo Grotius, the pensionary from Rotterdam, is also present. He shall advise his Utrecht friends how they must act. And behold, suddenly, Prince Morris enters the room. You need not think that these gentlemen were pleased with that visit. At least, they were terribly frightened. Morris tells them briefly and to the point what he has come for. In the first place, the local militia in Utrecht has to be discharged. In the second place, the oppression of the counter-remonstrants must come to an end. In the third place, they must permit that a national synod shall be held. Morris has told them briefly and distinctly those commands. But yea, these Lord Regents cannot give an immediate answer to that. They must first discuss that with each other. Very well, they may do that. Morris calmly leaves their meeting. Then the gentlemen can leisurely discuss these matters with each other. However, the next day he still has received no answer. Then Morris decides to take action himself. Those gentlemen must realize that he is fully determined, and that he will not permit himself to be trifled with. Do they not want to discharge the local militia? Very well, then he shall do it. Very early in the morning of the following day, about 3:30, he has the large market plaza of the city surrounded by his own troops. The cannons are placed in position. but they do not shoot as yet. In company with a few officers, Morris enters the plaza. He orders the commander of the local militia to lay down their arms. "I have received no instructions to that end from my masters," answers the officer who is in command. "Very well," answers Morris with a smile. "Then you shall have to fight for your masters." "Fight? Fight against the well-trained soldiers of Morris?" "No, those newly baked militiamen have no desire to do that. They dare not do that. The weapons are tossed upon a heap, and they may go home. All militiamen that are dispersed over the city of Utrecht are disarmed." But with all this, the case was not settled. Besides, the largest portion of the city council was sent home and replaced by others. The large cathedral was given to the counter-remonstrants. What a change, and all that took place without the shedding of blood. The militia was also discharged in the other cities of the provinces of Utrecht and Holland. But it did not remain with this. The principal leaders of the remonstrants, among whom was Oldenbarneveldt and Hugo Grotius, were made prisoners. Oldenbarneveldt was condemned to death by a court consisting of 24 judges. It was a heavy punishment, but just. By his stubborn attitude, he had brought the church into great danger and the country to the brink of civil war. As we have already written, he had committed high treason. At the age of 71 years, he was condemned to death in The Hague. It is true, for many years he had rendered inestimable service to the Netherlands. But that was not the reason why he was condemned to death, but due to his irresponsible actions and his boundless lust of power. He could only blame himself for that death. Even after his conviction, there still would have been a way for his preservation. If, after everything which had taken place, he had asked Morris for pardon, then he would have received it. Morris had waited for that. Morris has asked repeatedly if the Grand Pensionary had asked for pardon. But Oldenbarneveldt maintained till the end that he was innocent. Neither did his family ask for pardon for him, not his wife, not his children, not one. Yet even today they dare to blame Morris for that. They have the courage to speak of a black page in their national history. But bear in mind, and never permit yourselves to be talked out of that, the execution of Oldenbarneveldt is no black page in the history of the Netherlands. That sentence of Oldenbarneveldt was righteous. And we may not speak about a black page. On the 13th of May, 1619, that sentence was executed. Even upon the scaffold, he maintained his innocence. He said, "O God, what becomes of a person?" Indeed, what becomes of a person who against everything continues to maintain that he is right? How blinded that man was. Upon his gravestone they have written, among other things, "Let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall." It is a serious warning also for us. How Hugo Grotius escaped in a bookcase from Loewenstein, where he was imprisoned, and what has happened to the other leaders of the remonstrants, we shall not mention here, since this is unnecessary for our purpose. It also turned out sadly with the sons of Oldenbarneveldt. One of them even defected to the enemies, and has taken up arms against his own people. We may truly say, O God, what becomes of a person. We see in this history how that God has watched over his church in the Netherlands, but also how he has preserved that country from the horror of a bloody civil war.